The winners of the Migration Policy Institute's 2012 E Pluribus Unum Prizes, honoring exceptional immigrant integration work happening in the United States, discussed their initiatives during a plenary luncheon on September 24, 2012, at the National Immigrant Integration Conference held in Baltimore, Maryland. During a Q&A with MPI Senior Vice President Michael Fix, leaders with ACCESS, the Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services, Building Skills Partnership, Californians Together, and City Community Development discussed key aspects of their work. Eva Malona opens the luncheon, and Margie McHugh, co-chair of MPI's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, introduces the prize winners. And now, here's Eva.
My name is Eva Malona. I'm the Executive Director of Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition and the co-chair of the National Partnership for New Americans with my esteemed co-chair, Joshua Hoyt. It is our special honor and delight to offer a special welcome on behalf of the National Partnership for New Americans to the trustees and staff of the J. M. Kaplan Fund who join us for this session. So welcome. Also, we wanted to take a moment and on behalf of the National Partnership for New Americans and all that we represent to offer our special thanks and gratitude to J. M. Kaplan Fund and all the staff members for the support that they've given to the National Partnership for New Americans on our welcoming work, and also to the support of this conference since this was formed. This is enormous, not just for NPNA and this conference, but also extremely important to the fields of integration. And also a special moment to recognize the contribution of Suzette Brooks Masters with the J. M. Kaplan Fund. Thank you, Suzette, for your vision, for your leadership, and thank you so much for all your... We are very, very fortunate to have you. We know that the conference is just one of the several ways that the Kaplan Fund helped the field to evolve, and this signature investment of the fund is the topic of this session, the E Pluribus Unum Prizes. In a very short period of time since the prizes have been in existence, they have played a critical role in creating a better understanding of integration, increasing the profile of integration, and helping with the national debate. It has created a lot of excitement around immigration, a lot of respect for foreign-born and in their image and their asset to our society, and also helped tremendously the remarkable work that has been done across the nation in the field of integration. We are delighted to open this session. We are delighted to be part of this, and we also wanted to thank the winners today for the work that they have done. At this moment, it is my special honor to introduce the host of the event, the remarkable co-director of the National Center of Integration with Migration Policy Institute, my dear friend and colleague, the one and only Margie McHugh.
Thank you, Eva. Thank you, Josh. Oh, that might be hard to live up to. So on behalf of all of us at MPI, we just want to say a very, very special thank you to NPNA for including the announcement of this year's prizes here at NIC. And I want to say an extra special thank you to the phenomenal staff at CASA who have just been unflappable, completely accommodating. Just thank you. Please join us in. They just were so nice in figuring out any special request or scheduling issue and making it all work. Also, we're obviously deeply indebted to the J. M. Kaplan Fund for its support of the awards program. You'll hear a little bit later in the program from one of the grandchildren of the founder of the fund, but I want to acknowledge from the outset of today's program how essential their support has been, both to the prizes program and, as Eva was saying, also to the field, the growing field of immigrant integration more broadly. And Suzette, you were thanked for your vision and your energy. I also wanted to thank you in addition for how much you're doing in the larger world of philanthropy to bring attention to these issues. It's really essential to do that networking, and we really thank you very much for working so hard at that. So, yeah, why not? So many of you may know this is our fourth year of doing the prizes program. And in prior years, the way we would announce the winners was we'd have sort of a double event in Washington, D.C., an afternoon event where we would have two policy discussions, two policy panels. We'd have the winners up on the panels with different representatives of the federal government so that they could talk about their work. And then we'd have more of a party sort of in the evening. But what we were trying to do with that was very much try and push more proactive and coordinated federal approaches to immigrant integration. And it felt like that was just a great venue and way to go about doing that. But once we knew that the conference was coming to Baltimore this year, we really jumped at the opportunity to be able to showcase the winners here, compress the larger program that we had been doing into this luncheon plenary, but thinking what better place and what better audience to be able to honor the awardees and their exceptional efforts in front of, and also to communicate appreciation and respect for all of the smart and passionate work that this incredibly broad field is engaged in every day. So again, we just couldn't be happier to be here and to be doing the program in this way this year. So at least some, maybe many of you will know that the way we designed the prizes, we have a two-part definition for integration initiatives. We're saying through the program that we're trying to highlight exceptional integration issues each year now. We use a two-part definition. It encompasses both programs that are attempting to help immigrants and their children join the mainstream of U.S. society, and also programs that are building stronger ties between immigrants and native-born communities. And what you'll see in the awardees that we're recognizing this year is that many of them actually encompass both sorts of definition, both types of definitions of immigrant integration work. So obviously, most of the work, most immigrant integration work is happening on the front lines at the local level. And it's being done by many, many different types of institutions, businesses, and individuals. And also it cuts across very many different fields. And so a core purpose of the prizes program is to be trying to identify and reward some of that great work, in doing so to provide inspiration to others and to build knowledge and connectivity in the field and the various subfields of immigrant integration. Another core purpose of the program is to make this work, its breadth and its urgency, more visible and more a part of policy and reform thinking in a variety of fields. And those are both the fields, the various subfields like education, asset development, healthcare access, skills training and the like, as well as in the immigration reform debate. So what we're hoping with regard to those debates is that the program will help us create some common ground in debates about our future immigration policies, one where all sides are able to own immigrant integration issues and also work towards a common end goal of immigration and integration policies that are both intertwined and balanced with one another, so that we're truly fueling a more vibrant local economies around the country and cohesive communities, in a sense that we start to recognize in what have traditionally been very separate fields of immigration and integration, and also a sort of separate thinking in the national psyche about integration and immigration, that we have to pull those together and say that they are truly indivisible and that we really need to be thinking of both of them as intertwined. So with that in mind, I'd like to move now to, well, first I should say too, as I'm saying all this and looking at some of our advisory board members who are down here, you can only imagine, given just even looking at this room and thinking about all the wonderful work you've heard about here at the conference, how incredibly hard it is each year for us to choose the awardees. And it really, our advisory board has been such a crucial piece of this. We all wish that we had 20 awards to give out by the time we enter the room with the final 20, where we only have to pick a final few winners. So I just want to say at the outset that I hope all of you appreciate that this is a nearly impossible job, and that we just owe great thanks to the people who donate just hours and hours and hours of their time and their best thinking to helping us choose the awardees. So without further ado, let me start to introduce this year's awardees to you. They'll come up on the stage and get settled in. And then my wonderful colleague, Michael Fix, with whom I co-direct the Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, will have a conversation with them that's going to draw out important elements of their work and their thoughts about challenges and opportunities in what they're doing that that they and we think might be relevant to all of you across the different areas of integration work. So, and then we will have time for Q&A, and that's what the pens and the cards on your table are for. We didn't want to distract everyone during the conversation, so what we'd like you to do, if you don't mind, is distract other people at the tables in front of you and pass the cards up towards the front. So could the four awardees and Michael start to make your way up to the stage, and I'll start to introduce them. So first, I'd like to introduce Access. Access is the nation's largest Arab American human services provider. This Michigan-based nonprofit is being honored for its service to Arab Americans and other immigrants, as well as for taking a leadership role nationally in combating anti-Arab stereotypes and building bridges between native-born and immigrant communities. The organization was founded in a Dearborn storefront in 1971, and it now serves tens of thousands of individuals in the Metro Detroit area annually, offering a comprehensive array of services. Some of you may have heard Hassan speaking earlier today on a panel. They've moved from serving just the Arab American community, which is still very much its core, but working very closely with other populations in the Michigan area, and also playing a national leadership role, founding the Arab American National Museum, which is now a Smithsonian-affiliated institution. That's a must stop on if any of you are out in their neck of the woods. And also they have convened the National Network for Arab American Communities. So truly in what we saw in them was both a two-way model working very much to try and break down stereotypes and bring immigrant and native-born communities together, and also just an amazing array of programs that you'll hear more about during the session. So I'd like to welcome Hassan Jaber, who is the executive director of Access. He's right here to Michael's right. So next I'd like to welcome Building Skills Partnership. BSP brings together SEIU and the United Service Workers West, just a fascinating array of partners that are both building owners, building managers, high-tech companies, colleges, all in the service of trying to provide janitors and other low-wage property service workers with English language instruction, access to skills training, and more generally a boost in terms of becoming more integrated into the California community. In partnership with all these, with these unlikely allies, they have, they're providing tutoring and formal instruction. They have a really interesting model that works both with professional teachers, student volunteers, and office mentors. And so through their efforts, you actually have engineers and other high-tech professionals from Google, Microsoft, Cisco, Juniper, college students from out in California, acting as tutors and mentors for the building service workers that they're seeing often passing, in the night, in their buildings and in their offices, and instead actually taking time for these mentoring and conversation partnership sessions. And then in addition to having some really wonderful and we think scalable models for addressing language and skills issues, at the same time, BSP has really stepped up and is playing a very significant role in conversations out in California and advocacy on policy training for low-wage workers more generally. So it's a huge honor and pleasure to invite Aida Cardenas, who is the ED of the program, to join the panel today. Congratulations. And in case you thought it couldn't get any better, we have Californians Together, represented by Shelley Spiegel Coleman. Californians Together is a statewide coalition of parents, teachers, education advocates, school administrators, school board members, civil rights groups. They really are a classic coalition leverage model. You will not believe how tiny their budget is and how much they are getting done. Shelley is hot off of having the governor sign yet another one of their laws last Friday. Many of you know how bitter the debate in California has been, and the propositions that have been passed there. One of them was about bilingual ed, really turned the systems for language learning out there upside down. Well, in came Californians Together, trying to turn the whole debate on language education on its head by pioneering something called the Seal of Biliteracy. And for many years, they worked in innovating it, building both sort of the technical piece of it, working with school districts around its feasibility and the like. And in a not terribly long period of time, they have wound up just this past year with having it signed into law by the governor and having 10,000 high school seniors have a seal of biliteracy now on their high school diplomas, indicating to employers that employers, colleges, anyone they're submitting their diploma to, that they are biliterate in English and another language. So it really is creating a whole new conversation about issues of language skill, that having those language skills is a plus, not a negative. And at the same time, underneath all of this, they're doing all sorts of important research around issues for English language learners, having recently produced research and now had this successful legislation identifying long-term English language learners, writing into law that they had to be identified at the school level and get services that are appropriate to them. So we are just amazed and impressed by the work that they've been doing and are just so pleased that they're one of our awardees this year, represented by Shelley Spiegel Coleman, their executive director. Congratulations. And finally, we have our Corporate Leadership Award, which is presented to City Community Development for its work with nonprofit and public agency partners to reduce financial barriers to citizenship for eligible legal immigrants, and also more generally their work to expand financial inclusion and economic empowerment to underserved low and moderate income individuals and communities. Many of you were at the cross-session track yesterday, which talked about the program that city's been a key supporter of here in Maryland called Citizenship Maryland. It's a first-in-the-nation initiative by a major banking institution that offers microloans to help LPRs who are eligible for citizenship to afford the application fees. The magnificent CASA of Maryland, not surprisingly, is a core partner in getting that program underway and making it so successful. And Sheldon Kaplis, who's representing the initiative, will be speaking about some of the other partners as well that have been involved in the initiative. But we were so delighted, and we have a separate group that helps us in picking the Corporate Leadership Award. There are many institutions, businesses that are doing good work that's very aligned already with what their institutional interests are. But it tends to be of a more generic nature. And one of the things that was so impressive to us about the city initiative was that it really showed a lot of thinking and tailoring about how they could change a bit what they normally support in order to really do what was needed to have this particular initiative that was so tailored for immigrant communities actually succeed. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Sheldon Kaplis, who does the work in the Mid-Atlantic for City Community Development, and to say how pleased we are to have you as our Corporate Leadership Awardee this year. So with that, I'm going to turn the conversation over to Michael, and please don't forget, just write your questions and pass them up front, because we're eager to hear what you may want to ask the awardees. Thanks.
Thank you, Margie, and welcome to all. It is an absolute pleasure to be here. My name is Michael Fix. I'm the Vice President of the Migration Policy Institute, where I co-direct our National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, with my wonderful colleague, Margie McHugh. As you've just heard, we have another wonderful cohort of winners of the E Pluribus Unum Prizes. It's so competitive, it's so amazingly difficult to choose. And so we have a lot to discuss this afternoon. My mission is to lead a discussion, a conversation between the four award winners for 25 or 30 minutes. And then, as Margie said, we'll turn it over to your questions, which we assume will come forward in large, legible print. as I say, we have about 40 minutes. I have myself about 30 hours of questions for these great panelists. But so I think we'll just plunge in. And let me just say that I'll direct a few questions to each of you individually, but if others want to jump in and join the conversation, disagree, agree, amplify, that would be absolutely, absolutely terrific. So with that, let me start with Californians Together and Shelley Spiegel Coleman. We've been thinking, you know, not many immigrant integration organizations, small immigrant integration organizations take on systemic reform, much less systemic reform on the scale of the state of California. Californians Together is such a small, lean group. If you go to see Shelley, you climb the stairs to a single office in the church in Long Beach, California, where there are three workstations. But the work that they get done and the impact they have is just really, really striking. So if you would talk to us a little bit about your approach to reform, your strategies for reform, and as you do, please feel free to introduce, I think, the example that Margie talked a little bit about, the Seal of Biliteracy as a campaign.
Well, we were birthed out of our struggle with the initiative that Margie had referred to. In California in 1998, we had an initiative on the ballot that virtually made it illegal to have bilingual programs except in a very narrow possibility at school sites. And so we were the no on the initiative committee, a small coalition of 6 to 8 organizations. And when we did not defeat that initiative, we went away on a retreat and we tried to think about what would be happening. And we all said, well, if we had won, we could have said, good job, we'll see you at the next conference, at the next meeting. But what we said was there was a need to formalize our coalition to make sure that what happens in the state really does not deteriorate as much as possible what we know to be high-quality education for children learning a second language. So from 6 to 8 organizations over the last 10 years, we've now become 23 organizations. And the strength of the work that we do is the strength of the people who are at the table when we talk about what are the issues in the state and what are the campaigns that we could run to turn policy around, to make practice effective. And it is those voices that we bring to the table that make our small office appear to be an organization that spreads its wings throughout the state. So we have teachers' unions, we have administrators, we have school board members, we have civil rights organizations, legal services, attorney organizations are at the table, parent organizations are at the table. And I do think it is the voices of our organizations and the work that they do once we decide on what our campaigns are going to be that makes what we do happen. And so the example that you asked about, Michael, was the Seal of Biliteracy. Because of that initiative, you can imagine the whole controversy around language is very, very, very heated in California. And we are always trying to think about how is it that we can have change the hearts and minds of people to look at our students not as a deficit, not as problems, but as potentials for bringing tremendous talent and contributions to our community. There was one school district in the state, Glendale Unified, who developed the Bilingual Competency Award, and we looked at that and said that that was something that we thought could change people's attitudes about our kids. Look at them as really having talents. Look at them as being prepared for the 21st century with communication skills in English and another language. And after, you know, our famous governor, who you all know is no longer there, the actor, after he vetoed two bills that we got to his desk to create the state seal of biliteracy, we breathed a huge sigh of relief when we had Governor Brown elected. We sent another bill to his desk, and he did sign it. And so students walk now at graduation with medallions over their gowns, saying that they are bilingual and biliterate, and their parents see them as stars in their families. In a short period of 3 months of implementation of the state seal, as Michael said, over 10,000 students were recognized, representing 42 languages and American Sign Language. We think next year that will be doubled. We have 168 school districts that are participating. And we think, and after that, just 2 months later, New York heard about our law. New York entered a law, and where is New York? New York's got to be here. New York entered a law, and their law reads almost exactly like ours. Governor Cuomo signed their law just about 3 months ago, and they too have a New York seal of biliteracy, and we hope you all will have one.
Aida, the E Pluribus Unum Prize's signature in many ways has been two-way integration, models of two-way integration that Margie talked about. And when the advisory board was looking at what you do with Building Skills Partnership, we were really, really impressed with the way in which low-wage service workers, you engage low-wage service workers and at the same time engage high-tech professionals from Google and Microsoft and the like. And at the same time, you know, very smart students at the University of California, Berkeley, at Stanford, in this process of tutoring and building the skills of the service workers. Could you tell us a little bit about, just tell us about how this came about, why you think it works, if you have any lessons for using high-skill volunteers, which I imagine is a complex undertaking in and of itself. And then finally, you have persistence rates that many employment training programs just don't see. Multiple targets there.
Yeah, I think that with the dual integration, that's something that we definitely see throughout California, and we have a little bit of different programming in different regions based on the need. I'll share two examples. One is in the high-tech, biotech industries. I mean, the first thing that we're doing is we're partnering with employers and with big client companies to say, hey, let's get into the work site. Let's provide vocational ESL training for janitors who are working from 6 p.m. to 2:30 in the morning where, you know, many folks are at home or asleep. And we're really bringing them out of the shadows, really bringing a face to those folks who are providing a service, keeping the buildings clean, safe, disinfected, and invest in them. So the first thing is really the acknowledgement that they're there and that they're worth investing in. But we've taken it further than that, and in a lot of these sites, some of the sites you mentioned, is we have corporate volunteers who we coordinate to pair up for tutoring and conversation. But a lot of these folks are immigrants themselves or high-skilled immigrants, and their immigrant experience is maybe a little bit different and maybe don't understand each other but in terms of their experiences. So bringing them together around, but maybe both had challenges in terms of language acquisition. So being able to bring them together at the workplace and be able to dialogue around around those things and get to know each other really brings those communities together, but really changing the dynamic in the workplace. And again, acknowledging that whether you're a high-skilled, middle-skilled, low-skilled, everyone deserves to be invested in, and we're all part of making this economy run, and we're all part of making these buildings run. And so I think that that's been a great experience for a lot of folks. Right now, you know, just at one of our sites, we have 56 pairs of folks. That's, you know, 112 folks, you know, meeting, you know, every week to dialogue. So what we've learned is it takes a lot of coordination and training and making sure that people have the best experience. And if I may share another one from example from Los Angeles. So as we partner with employers and commercial real estate owners. You know, we're also bringing the workers out of the shadow for them, and for them as corporate leaders to understand the needs of immigrant workers and the workers who are cleaning their offices. And we do the vocational ESL project at the work site, and at the end, after 6 or 7 months, we do a graduation, invite the property managers, the employers, and the workers to a presentation. And just recently, we had one of the vice presidents of operations for J.P. Morgan. This is a building, Century Plaza Towers, two beautiful towers in the middle of Century City. Attended the graduation, and there he's part of the board of the Building Owner Managers Association, BOMA, who's actually BOMA is on our board and help us get going. And as the workers were graduating, he had pulled me aside and said, "You know, I was at the board meeting and we do this golf tournament every year and we raise money for scholarships. We don't really know where it goes, but I was thinking maybe we should direct him this way." And I said, "Really? Well, the guy who just got his certificate, Don Baldillo, his daughter is at her second year at Northridge. I go, and Juan Diaz over there, his son just got into Pepperdine and really trying to figure out how to pay for it." And he was like, "How do they pay for it?" Because he knows how much they pay, right? And so it's really bringing a community together in a different way. And he said, "I'm going back to a board, and that money that we're raising should go to the children of the service workers, the security officers, the janitors, the landscapers cleaning our building." So I think that, you know, it gives us an opportunity to work with our non-traditional allies and really find that thread and pull on it.
Excellent. Hassan, we were really incredibly impressed, of course, by the array of services that Access provides. I mean, Access provides served 70,000 clients alone in the last year, at least according to your application. You started in a storefront. You've obviously grown beyond your initial target population. You've obviously grown beyond the initial communities and zip codes that you originally served. As a group of people who work in this area, and as this integration field matures, you've had to develop the organizational capacity to serve new populations and to move into new fields. What are the challenges there? How did you meet them? How have you been so successful and flexible and dynamic over these last few years? Last few, I mean 30.
First, let me say, what a relief to come and speak at a conference when your first language is not English. So it is very helpful to be here, let me just say that when Access began, we began as an advocacy organization. The service part came after. So I think organizations need to stand for certain values, and what's incredible about Access as an organization that it does have values that speak to the issues of social justice, speaks to the issues of equality, speak to the issues of opportunity, and we try to keep an eye on what making us relevant and what making us successful. So I think to begin with, organizations need to stand for certain set of values and to focus on these values. The other thing is that really the growth came about in making sure that we are listening to what the community is telling us we need to be doing. We can't be successful in isolation of what the community is saying to us. I think when you look at the impact of the organization, in some neighborhoods where we initially started our services, there were neighborhoods where the rate of occupancy of businesses were less than 25%. When Access began serving in these neighborhoods, in less than 10 years, the occupancy was more than 100% of these businesses. Not only that, we were able to move recently new immigrant community, the Arab American community, from being isolated, removed, intimidated, to now a community contributing to a community of 11,000 small business, employing 170,000 people in these small businesses, and generating almost $7 billion of revenue to the state. So I think organizations can make an impact, not only in terms of the day-to-day needs, but combining advocacy with service and combining keeping an eye on how we move communities into these objectives of equity and jobs and protection of civil rights, and I think that's an experience that has been successful, and we've taken this experience now. We 7 years ago we started this network of Arab American community organizations that grew from seven organizations to now 22 organizations in 11 states, and they all are frankly copying this model of connecting immigrant communities with organizations that serve in the needs of these communities, and connecting service, the mission of service, with the mission of advocacy and the values that we need to keep an eye on. So the challenges are many. The challenges is how to keep this balance between advocacy and service. At Access,
we'll come back to the challenges.
Okay.
I promise. Mm-hmm. okay, Sheldon. everybody wants to get business more deeply involved in the immigrant integration enterprise. Business is obviously central to the immigrant integration enterprise. You don't really see very often the kind of level or kind of program engagement that we see with Citi, with CASA around the issues of citizenship and financial empowerment. Did it push your institutional comfort zone to get into this partnership, to go into these sets of issues? And I think for the people in this room, do you have any advice for people who want to get businesses more deeply engaged in initiatives like yours? And I'm not going to let you go just there. I also would like you to tie, which I think is so interesting, this notion of promoting citizenship and financial responsibility in the same project. So, again, multiple targets because we have.
Sure. First, let me say that this was a wonderful collaboration between Citi, CASA, NCLR, and some other donors. We didn't do it ourselves, but I think to respond to your question, I think it begins for us with a trusted partner. We knew CASA, and we knew their leadership, and I had spent considerable time with them over several years. And so when they first brought up this need, and they actually talked about it in a sense that they needed money for a loan fund, and I really thought I said, well, you're talking to the wrong person. You really should be talking to the commercial lenders or the, you know. So they said, no, what we really want is a contribution. I think that it was in the framing of the concept, and that is that our priority is financial inclusion and it wasn't necessarily citizenship in the beginning. And when you say, did it push us, I think initially it did, because we know that immigration is a controversial subject. But what we said and how we couched it, and I did among our colleagues, was this is about people that are doing the right thing. This is about legal permanent residents who want to take the last step. To me, it was apolitical. It didn't matter what side of the fence you were on. This was what everybody talked about, was give us the pathway. And sort of everybody nodded and said, that's right. I think what we were able to do was, again, to be able to bring in not just CASA's expertise, but CDFIs like LEDC that's here today, who understand the loan business, because that wasn't the business that CASA was in. They understood the people part, and they understood the steps towards citizenship. So I think that was important as well. So when we talk about a partner's willingness to look outside themselves, they said, we don't have to do it all. There are people out there that know parts of this work better than we do. Let's engage them. That's something that Citi is very supportive of and considers when we do our granting. And I think as we began to put this to paper, we were able to tweak it for them so that it didn't just become, well, let's give people a microloan and let them pay it back. It became about financial inclusion, it became about financial education. It became about coaching. It became more about, let's really talk about what these people are going to be able to do once they become citizens and hopefully improve their economic lot. So we wanted to pull credit reports. We wanted to make sure that the repayment of loans counted towards improving the credit score. So this was expertise beyond me. These were my Citi colleagues who really helped strengthen it. So it was a team, and it was a fascinating team.
I tell you, I was a little skeptical initially, but one of the things that absolutely strikes me is that in terms of the research underneath the program is that if you're a family, families with just $500 in savings have far fewer problems managing their finances than others. I mean, right. $500 you think is a rather modest right. amount of money, but right. And so linking the citizenship and the loan for the citizenship fee and dedicating the final payment to the creation of a savings account is just a really remarkably shrewd strategy. Okay, so may I just say that we've reached the mark where we're going to be looking for your legible questions to be making their ways down to tables 3, 4, and 5 at the front. And we're going to be moving through this conversation for the next several minutes, and then we're going to be turning to your questions. So let me just, I have to ask one more question of Shelley while I have her here in this intimate setting. Californians together, has been at the absolute forefront of putting the issue of long-term English language learners on the state agenda, on the national map, and before the public. Tell us in a word, because we're short of time, why this issue is so important and what the people who work on education reform and immigrant integration reform should have as their target policy and practices, just the top, the top.
Well, part of our work, as I said, is to improve practice. And so for us, for those of us who are in the coalition and are grounded in schools, we certainly know at the secondary school level, students in grades 6 through 12 who are English learners have a multiple profile. They're not a homogeneous group. And so we also knew from our work with several school districts and with schools that there were students in those grade levels who had been English learners since kindergarten. So they came to our schools as kindergartners, not speaking one word of English, motivated, excited, their parents thrilled about their potential, and year after year, through our school system, not having an appropriate program for them, or not having the services that were needed, those students have remained English learners. And so we look at students in grades 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, they're still English learners. So what we did initially is we collected data from 40 school districts around California, representing over 175,000 students, English learners in grades 6 through 12. And we looked to see how long had they been English learners, where were they in their language development, where were they in their academic achievement, and what we found, surprising, not surprising to us, but validated what we knew was happening in the school, but shocking to the whole state system, is that 59% of all the English learners in our secondary schools have been with us for 6 or plus years and have not become fluent or academically proficient. And so what we did was we created a policy and research document. We set about creating recommendations for local school districts and recommendations for the state. Part of the issue is these students are invisible. They're oral. If you talk to them, you think they're fluent, although their language, they need more precise language, more academic language, but you would think they're fluent. And so they're sitting in mainstream classrooms, or worse than that, in intervention programs that were not developed to meet their needs. And so what we needed to do as the first step for addressing these students is to make them visible. And hence the law that we just were hoping the governor would sign. We weren't sure it was going to happen, but it was so nice that it happened Friday before I got on the plane to come here. In California now, we have created a definition for what a long-term English learner is, so the districts can talk about the same group of students across the state. We've also created a definition for what a student at risk of becoming a long-term English learner is, so that we can catch kids early and hopefully prevent them from being long-term English learners. And the state now is required to report to every school and every district the number of students who are long-term English learners and students at risk, so that they are making the students visible and they can begin addressing their needs. For us, it's really an issue of having, turning the education system around so it focuses on who the students are, not what the reform is, but who are the students. And so we again know that this is an issue across the nation. With our report, we're invited back to the United States Department of Education to deliver the research that we did on it. They did a live webinar on it. Over 11,000 people across the nation watched that webinar. We know it's an issue across the nation, and we know we'll be working with many of you on the same issue. Thank you.
Thank you for the questions, which even I can read. And so we'll... And we're going to move to this round now. And Aida? We have a question here. How has Building Skills Partnership changed employers' notions about the value that unions add to our society?
Employers. Great question. I think over the last couple of decades, as I mentioned, the contentious relationship, you know, labor and management and working in the with SEIU to really set a standard in terms of wages and working conditions. And although sometimes those agendas conflict, really together as employers and labor have been able to create a certain stability for the service workers. And as we started the Building Skills Partnership, and when we went in 2008 and said, you know, it's about time now that you start committing and investing and putting it as part of the collective bargaining agreement for the employers to actually pay into a training fund so that we have a lifeline. That's what we call it, our lifeline. We were able to get that, you know, that vote of confidence. Okay, we believe, we see the pilot programs, we're going to invest. And going back to 2012, when we went back to bargaining, the fact that the program was still supported and they actually increased funding in such difficult times is a testament to how employers see a value in it. You know, at the beginning, it's like, yeah, we'll let you do it, sounds good, let's see how it goes. But now we have employers who meet with their client companies and say, this is what we have to offer as a company, and by the way, we have, you know, we have additional vocational training or ESL and other programs available to the employees that clean your building. So the employers will contact us and they'll say, hey, we want you to do the program at, you know, Nestle Building in Glendale, and we'll go out and meet and get it all going. So I think they see it as an added value, and and they're saying it now. How do they set themselves apart as a responsible employer? You know, one of the ways is to set a certain standard of wages and working conditions for the industry, that they're not bottom feeder companies, that they're not racing to the bottom in terms of, you know, of what they cost to clean a building, that they're really, as an industry, coming together and creating a standard. And that now they're beginning to realize or include into that standard the job skills. So they say, our employees understand green cleaning, our employees can read the chemical labels, our employees understand job and safety, you know, at the job, our employees understand waste management and the new recycle system. They can communicate in case of an emergency. God forbid there's an emergency in a building late at night where tenants still work. We've talked earlier in the conference about there's no longer the 9-to-5 workday. You have a lot of folks who are working late at night. What happens if there's an emergency? Janitors know those buildings in and out better than anybody, so they can communicate. Or if they see a suspicious package, or if there's an earthquake, is there any of those types of emergencies? The employers are now seeing, hey, these are things that we now have the capacity to do because we have Building Skills Partnership. Individually, each company, these 40 companies, individually would be a big challenge for them to do, because we know how to access them, we know how to get to them, we know how to put curriculum together that they're going to respond to. So I think that's where they really have seen the added value, and they market themselves that way.
Hassan, here's a very interesting question. How has the current cultural explosion in the Middle East affected attitudes in your Midwestern host communities?
I think the biggest challenge was obviously the tragedy of September 11th.
Current cultural explosion.
We are still really seeing the impact of that tragedy. I'll tell you that most Arab Americans before September 11, if you ask them about what are your priorities, what are the things that you care most about, they would say to you, the conflict in the Middle East or foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy is, you know, we've seen a shift after September 11 in the Arab American community from being foreign policy is the issue to issues of civil rights, immigrant rights, schools and education, and communities. It's amazing that we keep on focusing on the negative impact of September 11 in terms of relationship. There are amazingly dangerous laws and practices now that targets civil rights of everyone. But there are also some amazing positive developments in terms of making especially Arab American and Muslim Americans and other minorities like the Sikh community actually want to be more involved in the day-to-day community issues. I can say that we witnessed this shift since September 11. Now, we need to remind ourselves that we have to be vigilant about stereotyping communities. We have to be vigilant about race characterization. And the reason access and the Arab American community in Detroit really survived that shock of after September 11 is the fact that it built relationship. It found itself in partnership with many other communities and in coalitions with many other communities. That fact really sort of managed the impact of September 11 on the community. And I can tell you that a few hours after the tragedy of September 11, I got maybe 15 calls, threatening calls to access, but then I got almost 500 calls of support and saying, we are one community and we want to support each other. That dynamic is still going on.
Very nice. Shelley, does Californians Together have on its radar the need to mobilize expansion of GED classes for potential DACA applicants?
As well
as community and consumer protection enforcement awareness and possible sham GED programs set up to defraud young people?
Yes. We in California, Californians Together is pretty much a K-12 focused organization, but we have done, this last year we were involved in adult education because in California, I'm sure you've heard, well, I'm sure all of you are too, we're cash strapped, right? Our budgets are horrible. And so one of the big areas of budgets that is being cut is adult education. For instance, in Oakland Unified School District, there is no adult education. The entire budget was cut. In Los Angeles Unified, it was cut by 50%. So that we were very involved. Los Angeles was going to cut 100%. So we were very involved in trying to maintain adult education as much as possible. So that for us, that is a very significant issue because it is the parents of our children, and for some of it is our high schoolers who are going to adult ed to try and finish their education. So in that area, it's very critical for us. The issue of the DACA, the new DACA action that we have been getting calls on has really been from people within the school systems. They are now being inundated by the young adults asking for proof of attendance so that they can apply. And schools just opened, you know, just a month ago, and they were not prepared for this. So in LA Unified, it's thousands of kids that are asking, young adults that are asking for their records, and the system was not set up. Well, who do they go to? Who's producing those records? How are they turning them around? And so we're now trying to have a conversation to try and find out how best to help the school systems respond to the requests of the young adults.
Shelley, also a quick that we also found out that we need to organizations live in silos and the government live in silos and institutions live in silos. We found out that when immigrant kids come to the community, they are on average behind, 2 years behind because of language and other reasons. But then if you simply give them 2 extra hours a day of support and tutorial, they can actually in less than 2 years catch up with the average kids. You just need to break that silos of school systems that they just don't want to engage communities. And we found this to be a simple answer, but very powerful in terms of results.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to ask one of my own questions now, because I wanted to ask this and didn't get around to it. So let's look out 2 to 4 years. Independent of who wins the presidential race, what are the challenges that you see to your institution's successes, and what are you doing to begin to to take them into account and overcome them?
I think I've always worried about about forgetting our mission and the purpose of why we exist as an organization. Anytime that you get so busy with the many things happening on a daily basis and you forget why do you exist as an organization, that's a very risk that we need to continue to remind ourselves of why we do the things that we do. But then the other issue is because I'm from the Detroit area, because of the very critical challenges that we face in with the economy, losing 1 million jobs in the last 10 years, the needs is growing much faster than our ability to respond, and sometimes we miss the fact that to really deal with this issue, you need to engage the community in a much stronger way than any other time before.
I think for me, I see the challenges in the next 2 to 4 years, like thinking broader and thinking workforce development. I think a challenge and an opportunity for us, and something that maybe we need to challenge, is looking at how we're investing in workforce development and what that means. And there's a lot of resources, and particularly public funds and through workforce investment boards and other monies. And I think that we need to challenge ourselves to really look at what the need is and not just have this focus of, well, we have so much unemployed, let's give them training, get them into a job. And that's the vision and that's it. I think we really need to take a look at how do we look at underskilled jobs, make them higher skilled jobs, make them, more, professionalize them, or invest in workers who have a job but maybe have a language barrier and have other skills. With the language barrier, can really have other opportunities. Or, you can have, invest in security officers who want to go into law enforcement. And I think that as a community, really thinking about not just the panicky reaction of training those so that they can get a job, which is very needed, but also looking at the big picture and how do we really move people along and invest and, the underemployed and the underskilled, because I think that in the long term will really help address broader issues and really bring up the skills which are really needed in our job market, and not just continue to create, low-skill, low-wage jobs, but let's invest in those who need it and who want it and who want to learn and who want to grow and who want to develop.
For the kindergarten through 12th grade sector of our community, clearly what's ahead of us in the next 2 to 4 years is this whole wave of the Common Core standards, new assessments that are coming down, and new curriculum. For us, that provides a potential, a real potential for us to enter into the conversation and say, what does that mean before you get started for students who come to school not speaking a language other than English? Because these initiatives are so large, they're so wide in scope, and the change is so significant that the conversation tends to be on the initiative again and not on what it means for the groups of students sitting in front of the teachers. And so we have hopes that we can do this new approach so that it does respond to the kids, but we're also worried because we see the rollout on all of what's happening. Because the switch is so significant, people are trying to talk about the general overview so everybody gets the message. And then when people raise their hand in the audience and they say, but what does that mean for students who don't speak English? There are no answers forthcoming from the people who are really speaking to the reform. So for us again, it's really to raise the issue. We've actually developed an advocacy kit, a Common Core advocacy kit. And we're going to have little talking cards for people who are sitting in discussions and training so they can go, but wait a minute, what does that mean for? But wait a minute, what do you think about this? Because people don't have the language even yet to enter into those conversations. So we're really looking to see what will it look like 2 to 4 years from now. We're hoping it will be a lot more sensitive.
Make a comment about philanthropy in the next 2 to 4 years?
Yeah, do that? Great, fabulous.
Because I think philanthropy will continue to be under pressure. I don't think we're going to see the growth that we would like. And I think for programs that are searching for private funding, outcomes are going to be key. I think particularly in workforce, You know, we've gotten past how many people you serve. It's about job placement. It's about job retention. And I also think that the pressure on both nonprofits and funders to come together in a different way than they have.
I just want you to know about half these cards asked essentially in a nutshell this question.
Okay.
How best to get other financial institutions involved in work similar to what Citi is doing? So if you could say a word about that, and then we'll pull this session to a close.
It's a great question. I think you have to be vigilant in terms of looking at what these companies fund. You may not find a financial firm that wants to fund the Citizenship Project, but it's interested in workforce development. And if you look at some of the financial institutions, notably Bank America, they've shifted a lot of money this year into workforce development, but it's outcome-based, and that's going to be critical. So I think it's about language, and I think it's about trying to sharpen what you're trying to do, so that, not to chase the money, but that it comes in line with what those priorities are. Because I think there's still a lot of folks that don't get it. I mean, and on both sides, that they don't understand each other, and it's too easy to just say, we don't do that.
And I just want to close personally by saying that, you know, I've worked on immigrant integration for many years, and I have to say that I think the most rewarding, most high-impact work that I've been associated with is this prizes program. And so I would like to thank the board of the Kaplan Foundation. I would like to thank our incredibly able and energetic program officer, Suzette Brooks-Masters. And I'd also like to thank Margie McHugh for its great success. And I want to thank this outstanding panel.
For more information about MPI's work on immigrant integration and the E Pluribus Unum Prize award winners, please visit www.integrationawards.org.